underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester Center, Vermont, and Saratoga Springs, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a new Bachelor of Science degree in Public Health with a focus on social, physical, and behavioral sciences. strose.edu.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Once known as the largest ghetto in the U.S., notorious for the 1964 race riots and immortalized in Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing, the Bedford-Stuyvesant Brooklyn of today is more notable for its headlines in the real estate section. But as overt and systematic racism converges with the steady march of gentrification, the neighborhood again finds itself at the center of a cultural quandary, and Brian Platzer's debut novel, Bed-Stuy, is burning. Brian Platzer's writing has appeared in The New Yorker, McSweeney's, and The New York Times. By day, he teaches middle school English in Manhattan and lives in Bed-Stuy. It's a great pleasure to welcome Brian Platzer to this week's book show. Thank you very much for being with us, sir. A great pleasure.
Oh, thank you very, very much for having me. I'm a big fan of the show.
Well, thank you. At what point did you look around you of where you were living and think that you would like to explore it in this way through literature?
It's a great question, and it was a slow transition from just a place where I was living to one that I felt not only compelled but qualified to write about. I moved into Bed-Stuy 7-8 years ago with my wife, incredibly naive. Essentially, we were looking for a home. We were going to have a family. We wanted a little bit more space within commuting distance from Manhattan, and Bed-Stuy checked all those boxes. And for the first year or so, we were just settling in. You know, we were getting to know our neighbors. We were the first non-black family on the block, and there might have been a little bit of skepticism around us initially about what we were doing there, if we were just buying to flip the house and make a buck, or if we were really gonna live there. And once we had kids and we started to settle in, neighbors became friends, and I began to be more aware of what it meant that people like me were transitioning the neighborhood from one of the largest historically black neighborhoods in the country to a gentrified combination of peoples. And, you know, I had conversations with my neighbors about the benefits of gentrification initially, how, you know, it was helping their home prices skyrocket and more amenities were coming into the neighborhood. But I also started to understand the downside. The fact that the home prices rose made the rents rise as well. And there were people who were living in the neighborhood for generations with all their friends and all their family who all of a sudden couldn't afford a rent that was, you know, 2-3 times what it had been just a decade before. So all these thoughts were swirling around my head. I was thinking about what it meant to play the role that I was playing, what it meant to raise kids in that neighborhood. And this was under the previous, actually 2 police commissioners ago in New York City, Police Commissioner Kelly, who was a big proponent of the stop and frisk method of policing, which meant that primarily young black teenagers would be stopped if there was any reason for suspicion about them, and they'd be frisked to see if they had guns on them. And there's a reasonable debate on both sides whether the policy worked because violent crime did go down at that time, or whether the trend lines were in that direction anyway. But the day-to-day lived experience of it was horrifying. You had these teenagers, the same teenagers every day as I was commuting to teach middle school. They weren't much older than the kids I was teaching. They'd be shackled and handcuffed up against the fence that separates the stairs up to the street from those down to the subway station. They were mortified. The police seemed to be stoically, you know, doing their job, but didn't seem thrilled about it. And we commuters, you know, for whom this was theoretically done, were completely impotent to change anything or to interrupt or to help in any way. So it was after a month or two of, you know, day after day seeing these kids being stopped and questioned and frisked that I began to imagine what would happen if tensions ratcheted up a little bit. And I started sketching out some characters.
One of the things about those kids is the age. I mean, you're talking about 11, 12, 13 years old. These are young kids.
There are the 18 and 19-year-olds as well, but studies demonstrate that especially in minority communities and in those, especially in Black ones, ages are a lot more fluid in terms of police stop and frisks, where you would rarely, if ever, see a 12-year-old white kid be stopped and frisked. But it was a routine part a lot of my neighbors' days.
Give us an idea of the time frame of the novel. This is a view of one catastrophic day in that neighborhood. How did you decide to put it in such a compact period of time?
What I wanted to do was I wanted to create as many different perspectives as I could who would be affected by that day, and then to compress it so people acted, you know, not necessarily as they would on a casual day on a lovely block in Bed-Stuy with tree-lined streets with some tension simmering in the background, but I wanted to compress the tension into one day where everybody needed to react not only as they would normally, but with real necessity and urgency to protect their homes and their families and their financial well-being. I felt that if it all happened in a single day, then the tensions would create the sort of dramatic intrigue that I felt was necessary if I wanted to delve into these issues.
You mentioned a moment ago the characters that you created. Let us begin with Aaron, who is a former rabbi, leaves religion behind, goes to work on Wall Street, and arrives along with his girlfriend, Amelia, who is a journalist. Tell us about these two characters.
Aaron went into rabbiing for, I don't know, I guess the same reason I would go into rabbiing. He wanted to help people. He always enjoyed studying the Bible. The idea of being a pillar in the community was very appealing to him. But he realizes, after doing this for a few years, that he didn't have the faith that needs to buttress all of these conversations. So in interaction after interaction with members of his congregation, people who were suffering, you know, the deaths of relatives or loss of jobs, without having God to rely on, without being able to sincerely say, don't worry, this is part of some larger plan, there is some larger power looking out for us, he started to feel like a charlatan. And he felt not only his congregants' pain, but his own inability to help anything. So he had a bit of a breakdown, and he tried to replace that experience of religion and being an upstanding member of the community with a similar rush in his life. And he ended up finding gambling. And I loved the idea of a gambler as a gentrifier, and then a gambler who now works on Wall Street as a gentrifier, because I thought that was a good representative of what so many gentrifiers feel going into a neighborhood, you know, taking the risk, living among people who they think aren't like them, and, you know, not knowing whether the house would appreciate in value or not. It's a mindset that a lot of my gentrifying friends feel. There's almost a thrill to it that, with some distance, is probably patronizing and racist, but in the moment feels very true to the experience. So that's him. He was a rabbi, and then he becomes a gambler and a gentrifier. And his girlfriend is a writer, but she, up until when she moved into Bed-Stuy and started thinking about some of these issues that we're discussing right now, was a profiler of celebrities. And she's fighting, you know, the battle within herself about whether that sort of writing still interests her when there's so much depth and more compelling narrative surrounding her in her new neighborhood.
So they move to this neighborhood in Bed-Stuy, and along with a tenant in their building, Daniel, they are the only whites pretty much in that neighborhood. However, they are welcomed in the community until this act of violence, and a 12-year-old Black child is shot and killed by the police. At that point, things start to change. What did that allow you to explore?
It allowed me to explore the degree to which I feel that people, when times are easy, are able to be generous and charitable and at their best. You know, this couple is able to have friendly relationships with neighbors on the block because most of what they discuss is the neighborhood or the weather or sports or real estate. But when it comes down to pressured situation where people have to react to protect their family, I think a lot of that altruism disappears. I think we like to believe that we live in a world where people are looking out for one another and where everybody is, you know, as excited about their friends or neighbors' well-being as their own. But once things become violent, I wanted to demonstrate the degree to which people, you know, hunker down and really become selfish and, you know, care about their own well-being first and the well-being of their families. And then after that, if they have time, the well-being of their friends and neighbors. And I wanted to demonstrate the real naivete that I think most gentrifiers come into these new situations with, where they want to help out, but they don't actually want to dedicate their time and energy and money to sacrificing their regular routines and, you know, working in a noticeable way in the community. And I'm using the third person. I'm saying they, but I very much mean me. It's taken years for me to understand that I was getting so much more out of the community than giving it. But I wanted that same human instinct to be visible in the longtime Black residents in the neighborhood as well. You know, in no way is it the naive white guy coming in and, you know, ruining the lives of pristine Black people. It's everybody is out for themselves and their family and their security and financial well-being. And I felt that once I was able to speak from different perspectives, and I did, you know, all the academic research about gentrification in Bed-Stuy and the history of gentrification, different methods of policing, and hundreds of hours of interviews, my check on myself was I wanted to create a situation filled with that kind of tension, and Bed-Stuy is burning. But then I wanted every action that my characters took to be recognizably self-serving in not a critical way, but in what I feel is a very human one.
Brian Platzer is our guest on this week's book show. The name of the novel is Bed-Stuy is Burning, and it is published by Atria Books. When you look at these characters and you get down to it, it is ultimately what they are looking for, what most people want, I think, in life, to raise their children in a good way, establish themselves, find work, find love, and just get through life.
That's exactly right. And I think in a lot of the conversations about cultural appropriation, which I think should be raised in conversation about this book, and by cultural appropriation, I mean a member of one culture or ethnic group or race writing from the perspectives of others, I feel that that commonality often gets lost. And there's a totally reasonable argument on both sides of the cultural appropriation conversation, which is being had right now. What one side believes that it's really not only unfair, but impossible to adequately represent somebody whose experience you haven't shared. And not only impossible, but immoral at a certain point if you benefit financially from it or you write a book about it. And I entirely understand that perspective. But I strongly believe the counterargument to that, which is that far more, you know, is similar among these characters than is different. As you say, they're all looking to educate and keep their kids safe. They're all looking for financial and emotional stability and sex and love and all the things we are. And to avoid writing from other people's perspectives or to say one shouldn't, I fear creates a gap. You know, it broadens that gap. It sort of creates this category of the other where it would be my saying, you know, I didn't feel like I could even understand the experience or I shouldn't even try to. And I felt that in order to tell this story correctly, not only would I need the gentrifier's perspective as the catalyst for a lot of these events, but I would need the people who benefit from that gentrification and the people whose lives, you know, markedly suffer from it. So what you say, I think, is exactly right. I want to point out the differences, and there are real tangible differences among the experiences between the various characters, but I also wanted to focus on those similarities.
The other thing that you realize in reading the book is that any of these neighborhoods or our neighborhoods is as complacent as we become, could be, not will be, but could be one police shooting away from complete chaos.
That's exactly right. And I accidentally wrote into the zeitgeist a little bit with that. I mean, I began the novel 6 years ago or so, before the incidents outside of St. Louis and in Baltimore and in Cleveland. I felt the tension in the air, but I never imagined the degree to which that tension would be made real. So although I do specify real details of a street in the Bedford-Stuyvesant neighborhood and real restaurants and real apartments and houses, I did want that feeling to be universal, that sense of the calm in which we live 95, 99, almost 100% of our lives could be pierced with just a sudden, you know, instance of violence, which is why I didn't go into the police shooting itself. The novel wasn't about the detective story of what really happened. It was important to me that the novel begin after that moment of violence, so we could see a community just like any other community unravel.
One of the things that I find so interesting about the novel is, this is going back to the character of Aaron, who is a lapsed rabbi, but this allows you to take a look at the relationship between Jews and Blacks and the complicated nature of that relationship over the past 5 or 6 decades.
I'm so happy you brought that up. Brooklyn is known as the borough of churches. You walk around on a Sunday and you see the degree to which, cultural life is just dominated by the church. People are listening to sermons from their churches, but from the streets as well. People are dressed up in their Sunday best and going to lunch afterwards. But the relationship specifically between Blacks and Jews over the last few decades, as you say, is fascinating because there is a history of Jews giving opportunities to Blacks at a time when others wouldn't. Opportunities including renting houses to them, renting apartments to them, offering jobs, allowing them into educational institutions. But you see, even as I'm explaining it, it's impossible to avoid sounding patronizing in this discussion, which makes it all so much more complicated. But in addition to that history, you have, of course, the most infamous riot of New York's last few decades, which is the Crown Heights riot, which was primarily between the two groups. And then you complicate that further by having today a lot of the larger developers who are moving into these neighborhoods and gentrifying are religious Jews who are accused often of wanting to keep these newly renovated homes white, whether for racist purposes or because they feel like they can get more rent out of other people with, you know, negative inclinations towards Black people. So this conversation is constant among my neighborhood friends and, other parents, always talking about how, you know, some people say Jews are more like Blacks and we can, you know, relate in a different way because we've experienced the history of oppression. And other people express, you know, real frustration about Jews who are moving in and, more rapidly changing the neighborhood than a way that they're comfortable with. And I, as a Reform, partially believing Jew, straddle a line where I want to benefit from the conversations where that relationship feels warmer, and I want to distance myself from those where there's that animosity. And it's a relationship, a historical one and a personal one, that I wanted to make sure I included.
And also a political one. I think it's one of the things that you bring out that's so fascinating, that these issues of history and morality and faith and how those questions become political questions in this day and age.
Absolutely. Because, I mean, just to take the most obvious example and one that we've touched on before, policing follows gentrification. So initially, people move into a neighborhood, white people, and the statistics show that police follow that, especially before the commissioner after Kelly Bratton's broken window policing, which did a better job of putting cops where crime was. Under Stop, Question, and Frisk, you had a lot more police in areas that were more rapidly gentrifying. And initially, I saw that as a political benefit. You know, my wife, who is as small as I am, would have a cop there as she exited the police station and walked on the way home. And that was a political decision that benefited us. But then it was it's those same police officers who complicated the lives of, and I use complicated as a pleasant euphemism, complicated the lives of so many of my neighbors' children as they were going to school. So decisions seem like they are local, and or they seem like they are political. But really, as you mentioned, they're a combination of everything above, which is one reason why I wanted Police Commissioner Bratton himself to be a character in this book, because I wanted to give the sense that the political reality was a personal one as well. And it wasn't just a, you know, anonymous puppet master pulling strings above people's lives, but it was just a guy who made a lot of decisions with other police officers making decisions, trying to probably do his absolute best to make neighborhoods safe, but discuss everything with a degree of dehumanization where everything becomes numbers when you hear him speak in his major speeches, that he's such a fascinating character that as important to this story as the gentrifier, as the local neighborhood girl, as the longtime owner in the neighborhood, was the police commissioner himself who was pulling political levers and changing people's lives.
When it comes to how readers, what they come into the novel with, as you say, you started this novel 6 years ago, and with the events, how do you think that shapes us and shapes the reader of coming into this conversation? I guess you can look at it both ways. One of them, the most positive way to look at it, is you come in with a more informed readership.
Absolutely. I think that the benefits of these public events are an increasing curiosity where a lot of people, a lot of good people, have been living unaware of the degree to which Black people and other minorities feel oppressed by our system of public order and policing. And I think a lot of the public uprisings or riots or whatever you want to call them, but in response to police brutality, as if you look in the history of the United States, the great, great majority of riots, race riots at least, are in response to police brutality. I think that the American who would have a decade ago lived a life unaware of the intensity of feeling around these issues now is curious. And I didn't have it in me to write an op-ed, you know, for the New York Times, because I realized very quickly that I didn't have answers. But what I did have was a perspective on the complexity of these situations. So people do know a little bit more factually, but I also think that people understand that these are issues that are affecting far, far more people than maybe, you know, my typical white reader would understand from a decade or so ago. But I also think Black readers and members of other minorities who have felt the oppression is a strong word, but have felt the force of police pressure are also newly curious about what all these, you know, liberal, I guess would be a word, what all these liberal white people are actually thinking and the degree to which we do feel anxiety or moral shame or excitement or opportunity in these moments. I wanted to take a new readership that was curious in all the ways you suggest and try to tell a story that's, you know, first and foremost entertaining, but soon after that, indicative of the fascinating complexity that takes place in these neighborhoods.
Did you end up coming up with any answers?
I think only that I and people like me need to be a little bit harder on myself. I was hiding behind the writing of this book, I think, as a moral action, as pompous as that sounds, but it was just providing me an excuse not to dedicate more of myself to giving more to the community that I took from it. So I do think that the answer, insofar as there is one, is to get to know as many people as possible, to get past that initial area of frustration and tension. And that goes as much for the longtime residents as people moving in. Maybe we have more of a responsibility to do it because we're the one affecting change, and therefore we should be going out of our way to make sure that change is positive. But I do think that just getting to know people, inviting them over to your house, and engaging in local community activities and block associations and libraries and schools, and making sure that you're playing with your kids at your park as opposed to other ones, is a definitely not sufficient but necessary first step.
Brian Platzer's debut novel is Bed-Stuy is Burning. It is published by Atria Books. Brian, a great pleasure to have you on the program. I wish you all the luck in the world with the novel.
This was so much fun. Thank you.
A great pleasure. Thank you. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org. And you can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LaDuke produces our program. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening. For The Book Show, I'm Joe Donahue.